Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the OnFit Podcast. It's part of the series where we look ahead to the ECB monetary policy decisions. We are in an interesting time for Europe. A new German government has been formed. France goes to the polls early next year, and the ECB is facing the end of its pandemic emergency purchase program, despite some questions when that might be. There are, of course, further questions around how transitory is inflation. This is a global question too. What impact will the new COVID variant have? And how will fiscal stimulus and monetary policy fit together post-pandemic? That's even before we get onto the threats of climate change. To discuss these themes in the context of how this impacts reserve management, I have with me today David Marsh, Chairman at OnFIF, and Dr. Max Castelli, Managing Director at Sovereign Institutions, UBS Global Asset Management. So first of all, I want to thank you both for joining me today on this, in London, cold December day. So I would start with the million-dollar question around, do you agree that interest rates are on the rise as the transitory rise in inflation appears to be more persistent than previously thought? Is this a correct assessment, and is it true globally, or are there regional discrepancies? David, I would like to go to you first, please.
Interest rates are on the rise, but more gradually in Europe than in the United States. The ECB is very likely to end its pandemic program at the end of March. Christine Lagarde has made that pretty clear. She's hardened up her stance, actually, on that, despite the pandemic seeming to get worse. And that is because of the inflation numbers. The headline numbers are quite alarming. The core numbers are less so. But even so, psychologically, it's going to be very, very difficult for the ECB not to end the pandemic purchase program at the end of March. They will put something else in place, I think, a kind of flexible response program, always stating that this is used only in emergencies. Interest rates will rise slowly from the negative level in Europe. I think that they will actually be forced to move before the end of next year. In the United States, it's a different story because the US has really thrown the kitchen sink at the economy, and it's been overstimulatory. In Europe, we have a more balanced picture, but still one where inflation, I think, will be around, but not at alarming levels. I think 2-4% is likely in the next few years.
Max, is this the same picture that you have and you're seeing when you're looking at the interest in inflation globally, but also in Europe?
Yes, first of all, hi from also a very windy day in Zurich. Broadly speaking, the market believe that the Fed is sticking to the transitory view of inflation, but definitely the market believe that there is that rates should be a little bit higher. So let me just give a little bit of numbers so that we put things into context. Most of the increase actually in yields in the US have been in the 3-5 year part of the curve. So we have an increase which oscillates between 60 basis points for the 3 year up to 80 basis points for the 5 year. Actually, if you look at the 10-year treasury, which is a very important yield, of course, actually the increase is a little bit more muted, about 65 basis points. And if you look at even longer duration, like 30-year, we only have an increase of 30 basis points. This is a little bit surprising if you believe in the sort of a narrative around inflation. Basically, the market seems to believe that maybe the rates, short and medium-term rates, should be a little bit higher, but also the market shared the view that over the long-term, inflation is not a major risk. Now, this to broaden the perspective beyond the U.S., we've seen a similar increase across also the market. Once again, let me give you just a number. German 7-10 year yields have increased year to date by around 46 basis points. The Swiss, which have among the lowest yield in the world, around 50 basis points year to date. Once again, in the 7-10 year, the only exception is, of course, Japan, where, as you know, the Japanese central banks control the yield curve directly. So the increase in the long-term yields has only been 8 basis points. Maybe one point, if I go even beyond the developed markets, is about emerging markets. Actually, we see several emerging markets taking a much more aggressive interest rate increase. I believe they are coming from a different history, if you want. They want to control inflation expectation as fast as possible because, of course, they have a long history of higher inflation rate and they've been they did not hesitate to increase rates in the current environment.
How do you think the new COVID variant fits into all of this? Have the markets been concerned about it in a way differently to previous variants, or is it just all part of COVID now? Max, to go to you as a follow-up for that.
Well, what we witnessed was, first of all, a very, very sentimental reaction to the news about the new variant. We always said that in the scenario that we have been building that the economy is recovering very quickly, and bar sort of new variant or a failure to end the pandemic, we believe that this recovery can continue. Of course, as soon as the news about this variant came out, immediately the market reacted by selling off very aggressively. We should also keep in mind that the market is very high, and certain markets are very high in terms of valuation. So it might also be that this has been, at least from a pure short-term sentiment point of view, an excuse also to cash in some profit as we approach year-end. Actually, the markets have been stabilizing a little bit in the last few days. And I think the market is taking a view about the potential impact of the variant in terms of social mobility. In the end, that's what really matters. To what extent this new development on the pandemic front will eventually force governments to introduce a measure, like, for instance, a measure which curbs social mobility, which can, of course, impact the economy. I believe in the market there is a view that the appetite for more stringent measures is relatively low at the moment. We are seeing government really taking a very, very cautious approach, because the last things they want, of course, is to bring back the economy on a low growth or even a new recession path. So from that point of view, I believe that if the news about the new variant are not too bad, in the sense that, for instance, the vaccine completely fail to control this variant and the sort of parameters like, for instance, mortality rates are much worse than what the market is currently expecting, I believe that the market should be able to digest this news. What is the impact on the macroeconomic picture? Well, this is a positive and a negative, I would say. On a positive, it might well be that sort of building rhetoric of central banks about hiking will in some way be a little bit more muted, because they will take a more cautious approach. But on the other hand, if instead this variant has a big impact in terms of mobility, in terms of the impact on the real economy, this could create further tension on the supply side, supply demand imbalance that we know is one of the main reasons behind the current increase in inflation. So I think we need to wait and see to really give a final judgment about the impact of this new development.
David, do you think that governments will look again to increase fiscal stimulus? So if sort of we play this out and there is another lockdown, the service industry massively struggles over Christmas. We're already hearing reports that within the UK and within Europe that people are cancelling their Christmas parties. If we think that that plays out and then in January there needs to be a review and another injection of fiscal stimulus, will that imbalance maybe the French election or the budgetary discussions in the European Commission are obviously looking to return back to normal and to end the pause for the Maastricht Treaty that they've had on during the pandemic? Do you think that this will have a huge impact on the fiscal side of the picture?
No, I don't. I think the key word is injection, the injection of stimulus. I think the fact that we've got the vaccinations now, which we didn't when this started in March 2020, just changed the picture enormously. And I believe the vaccine makers and the epidemiologists will take this in their stride. I hope I'm not being oversanguine here, but I also think that this is going to force governments into measures which have to do with obligation to take vaccinations. We all know that 80% of the people ending up in intensive care units are those who've chosen for one reason or another not to be vaccinated. And there is now going to have to be a touch of illiberalism by governments. You see this in Germany and other countries, to introduce the obligation to be vaccinated. I think this changes the picture tremendously. We have a battery of vaccine makers now, which we didn't have in March 2020. So I think we're going to be seeing the central banks and the governments taking more of a backseat. We're almost back to where we were in March 2020 when Christine Lagarde and I paraphrase slightly, we are not here to control disease. The central bank should be there to mop up, I think, after others have failed. But the buffers are first of all the medical profession, and secondly the governments, and then call in the central bank. So I think the central bank will have to be on normalization duty, because we do have a spike in inflation, which is not going to be purely transitory, even though we're hardly back to the Weimar Republic. So I do think we're going to see a more balanced and orderly way of dealing with this than we did in the initial rush in March 2020.
Well, we have some very cautiously positive and optimistic views of 2022, which are going into 2022, which is wonderful. But when we're talking around these transitory inflation or not, and the lower interest rates, Max, I want to come to you because a point that you basically made is that for the first time in a very long time, reserve managers face losses on their fixed income portfolios. So it'd be interesting to explore some of the implications of this. Should reserve managers continue to diversify away from government bonds? So if you could just sort of flesh out some of your thinking around that.
Sure. Thank you for the question. Absolutely. I mean, for sure, reserve managers are starting to face a situation which they have not faced for at least the last 20 years. My team at UBS Asset Management actually ran a sample portfolio that replicate the portfolio central banks from the most conservative one to those which are more diversified. And according to our estimate, which are updated at October end, year to date, all the fixed income portfolio central banks had negative returns. But what is very important to note is not only the long-term fixed income portfolio had the negative return, something which actually already happened for very rarely, but a few times already over the last decade, but also the portfolio with short duration, which are portfolio, for instance, invested in global government bond with duration of 1-3 years. So very often they represent the bulk of the reserve of central banks, has also suffered the losses. I mean, this is very, very important because, first of all, it is the first time in a very long time. Just to give you an idea, there will be a lot of portfolio manager in the trading desk of central banks which never experience a loss on short-term bond portfolio. Actually, there are some portfolio manager who probably never experience an interest rate rise cycle in their profession, because we didn't have one now for almost 13 years. So it will for sure be a wake-up call. Now, the new situation has some very important implication. In fact, reserve manager the primary objective of reserve manager are, first of all, liquidity, and we know that, and secondly, capital preservation, and I would put as a further return. Now, if you define capital preservation as at least generating a return which is equivalent to the inflation rate, and we assume a long-term inflation rate of 2%, now, in the past, reserve managers were able to meet this goal very easily, the return of a short-duration government bond portfolio in the last 20 years has been above 2%. In the future, this is going to be much more difficult, and unless there will be some change in the way the reserves are managed, they will either to accept a return which is lower than the inflation rate, or eventually they will have, as I said, to make some change to the way they invest the reserves. In terms of diversification, which I believe it is one of the most important implications of what we are experiencing. We shouldn't, first of all, diversification has been a trend which has been going on for a very long time among reserve managers. I mean, we monitor actually to our survey over the last 20 years. If you look at the typical asset allocation of our central banks nowadays, it looks very different from what it used to be 20 years ago. Now they can invest into corporate bonds, asset-backed security, emerging market debt, listed equity, and some of them even venture in alternative asset classes. And the point is, diversification has played very, very well for central banks from an historical perspective. The return has been almost double when you had the little allocation to equity. And in the case for, and also for the future, in our simulation, we see that a diversified portfolio with a little allocation, when I say little means compared to other institutional investors like pension funds or insurance funds, actually when they have an allocation of, let's say, 15-20% to listed equity, this portfolio is expected to outperform in any scenario, including a scenario of a higher interest rate and higher inflation. So definitely, I believe the diversification trends will remain and eventually will accelerate in the years to come as we move into the post-pandemic world.
And what are the risks of this? So you say that they outperform even with a higher interest rates, but do you see that this diversification, especially into alternative asset classes, do you see that there, what would be key risks be that we should be looking for if a policymaker is looking at financial stability or the markets are looking at financial stability implications? Where should the concerns be?
I mean, if you look at when this diversification took place over the last decade, of course, the central banks had also to change several parameters in their investment framework. For instance, they need to accept a higher level of volatility. It's pretty obvious that when you have a pure fixed income portfolio and then you start including asset classes like listed equity, even if in a smaller proportion, the volatility of the overall portfolio increase. And this has already been done. And nowadays, for instance, many central banks are prepared to accept a little higher volatility in the short term in order to guarantee higher return and better diversification over the long term. So that from that point of view, for sure, a further broadening of the investment guidelines, for instance, including alternative asset classes, will require an additional relaxation of their investment parameters. Now, the question about alternative asset classes is not very much about volatility and potential drawdown, but I think it is about liquidity. Liquidity, it is a very, very big historical bias of the reserve manager. And this could not be otherwise given the mandate that historical central banks had. But we should not forget many central banks nowadays sit on a level of reserve which is well above the level of liquidity required for even the most extreme intervention that they might contemplate, for instance, in the FX market or during a banking crisis. And actually, we start to have this type of conversation with our clients. We see central banks, of course, asking us, should we invest in alternative asset classes? And our answer is yes, because by preventing themselves from investing in alternative asset classes, they are at a disadvantage compared to other institutional investors. If the problem, the challenge is within fixed income and you want to replace fixed income, if you can only replace fixed income with equity, you need to accept a much higher level of volatility. Instead, if you can include, for instance, asset class like real estate or infrastructure, you can still have an asset which produces income, which is important, but at the same time with a lower level of volatility of compared to listed equity. This is a very powerful tool of diversification, and that's exactly what other institutional investors have been doing already for a very long time. But your question about the impact on financial stability is very well placed, because I remember we need to think about the past. Central banks, because of the way they invest and their traditional very high risk aversion, tend to have a more pro-cyclical investment behavior. I remember during the euro fiscal crisis, many central banks, there will be no number saying that this is more based on anecdotal interaction with central banks, they've been selling aggressively the periphery bonds. And it was very paradoxical. From one end, we had the central banks and the ECB trying to stop the sell-off, and at the same time, the reserve manager himself selling on the investment side. This is called sometimes a pro-cyclicality behavior. So selling when things get a little bit more volatile and buy when things go up. Now, if we move into this era of rising yields, one natural behavior would be to shorten duration in order to reduce the interest rate risk. This is something which, of course, if it's done in an ordered way, does not have many repercussions. But of course, if it's done in big numbers, can also have some repercussion. And here, the main risk that I see, which require close monitoring, is actually not so much about price movement, but it's more about the liquidity in the U.S. Treasury market. We had this already a few episodes which show that the Treasury market, the U.S. Treasury market, which we should not forget is the most important and the one which is considered the most liquid in the world, has went through some episode of stress on the liquidity side. Let's imagine what happened if we would really have a serious hike in interest rate, which would prompt many fixed income investors to sell very quickly long-term bonds in order to go into short-term bonds. This could have an impact. And I think I would not like to sound alarmistic, but for sure it's something that the policymakers should monitor very closely going forward as we move into this new regime.
Thank you very much. This is something that we look at OMFIF as part of our flagship publication looking at global public investors, and we survey central banks. And I'd say that what you are saying is also very much reflected in the findings that we have around the move, the central bank reserve managers moving into diversification away from government bonds. So I'm sure that we will be seeing more of that and exploring that further together. But David, I want to come to you because one of the other chapters we have in that publication is around central bank communications. So Max, I think you make a very good point that central banks will have to be more okay with volatility, but how do the central banks communicate that to the general public, to their to the markets, to themselves, and to their governments? I would say that that's a huge challenge and something that they're looking more and more at. So I'm going to come to the close of this in a moment, but David, please do build on what Max was saying, but also focus on the central bank communications of the implications of this.
As Max says, the central banks do tend to be risk averse. So some of those who are more traditional are going to take a long time, I think, about moving into the more adventurous asset classes that Max has been talking about, because they are afraid of making a mistake. I remember the Bundesbank more than 10 years ago, before the financial crisis 2008-2009, had been studying for some years whether or not it would go into asset-backed securities. And it took so long to decide that luckily it didn't make the decision to do that on the eve of 2008-2009. So sometimes inertia can be good for you. I agree that mathematically it does make a lot of sense, but I do query whether it's consistent with the mandates of many of the developed country central banks, with the noble exception, of course, of Switzerland, which is sitting on this huge pile of equities making up 20% of its vast currency reserves. But the Swiss National Bank is something of a law unto itself, I would say, and something of an outlier in Europe. In terms of communication, clearly central banks are having to do more. They're having to explain more. There's more parliamentary inquiries. They have to appear on press and television more. The new president of the Bundesbank will have to be an arch communicator. And that's going to be something which we've never quite seen before, at a time when, as Max says, we're preparing for increases in interest rates. The ECB last increase in interest rate was 2011. So people have somehow forgotten what it's like to tell people about rising interest rates. And it's going to be an enormously difficult job, this communication, getting the balance right, making sure that all the different audiences that you're speaking to, the very technocratic people who understand all this stuff, or the general public, or the politicians that want to make you the whipping boy and want to make you the scapegoat, getting the right balance between all those audiences is not an enviable task.
Thank you very much. I want to come to my final question, which is, Max, what do you think is going to be the largest change in reserve managers' portfolios or attitudes post-pandemic? So pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, what do you think is their largest shift of thinking?
First of all, I have great respect for central banks. These are institutions which have a very important mandate. We should not forget that reserve management ultimately is a secondary mandate with respect to the primary one, which is, of course, inflation and the control of the monetary policy. So from that point of view, I'm not surprised that central banks are very cautious when they need to make change. And we know that they are not the fastest, maybe, institution in terms of development. But if I look at what happened over the last 10, 15 years, I would say the central banks have been pretty active in, let's say, upgrading their toolkit. We should also not forget that central banks are often taken by the jacket from any angle. Just think about the debate about climate change. I don't think we can expect the central banks to address the climate change by themselves. But of course, they are very happy to play a role there as well, as we heard over the last, particularly over the last 2 years. I think that central banks needs to, anyway, continue to innovate. I believe the main area of innovation, if I have to think about something, it is about also to learn from other institutional investors how to really improve the governance which surround the management of reserve. We should not forget many of the public officials, central banks in charge of reserve management, are also in charge of monetary policy. So I think an injection of some good asset management practice that we already is becoming standard, for instance, in other sovereign institutions like public pension funds or sovereign wealth funds, I think it would also help a lot central banks to really look at the way they manage the reserve in the right way. So what I would say in the post-pandemic world, once eventually the emergency will be over from that perspective, we will see again a renewed focus on the upgrade of asset management practices within reserve management department, particularly the one which has David mentioned, the one that are sitting on a very vast pool of assets, which at the end of the day, they face multiple risks in the post-pandemic financial and economic regime.
Thank you very much. And thank you for joining us, Max and David. Do you have any final words, David?
But my final words are that we are getting into a regime of potential fiscal dominance where central banks will be afraid of raising interest rates, partly because they will be harming their own and other people's balance sheets. That's an important consideration. But also, they'll even more important, they'll be harming the balance sheets and the overall standing of sovereign governments around the world. And therefore, the more that central banks can do to offload some of the government bonds that they have acquired over the last 10 years, mostly I think that'll be simply through redemptions rather than actively selling the portfolios, the better we will be. Because otherwise, the central banks will be facing quite a vast conflict of interest. And that's going to add to all the other difficulties that we've been talking about here.
Thank you very much. I think that is an excellent summary of building the discussion from the start when we looked at inflation and interest rates and the key mandates of a central bank going into the secondary mandate, as you mentioned, Max, on the reserve management perspective. So thank you both for joining us. I think it was an extremely interesting discussion, and I look forward to a repeat in 2022 when some of these things are a little clearer or perhaps even less clear. But thank you, and thank you all for listening. Please do sign up to the OMFIF podcast to hear more of such discussions and also on the sustainability and the digital money aspects, which we haven't managed to get to in this discussion, but are key indicators of where central bank thinking is as well. So thank you very much, Max, and thank you very much, David.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OMFIF podcast.